Welcome to The World According to Crick. On this week's episode, we have an amazing expert that I'm kind of obsessed with because I'm kind of also obsessed with architecture. We have the renowned architect and designer, Bob Hale. And as you know from previous episodes, when I have people on this show who are much smarter than me, I get very, very excited. And so thank you so much for joining today.
It's my great pleasure, Craig. Thank you for inviting me.
So I know we're going to talk a lot today about a sense of place and space and home. But before we get there, I'd love for people to get to know you a little bit if they haven't Googled you or know from the background. And so you're an amazing architect now, but is that always what you want to do? Like, do people grow up and want to be architects?
Many people discover architecture later in life or as they're going through school. I happened to decide I wanted to be an architect when I was 12.
That's amazing. Do you remember the source of inspiration?
Yeah, actually I do. When I was in seventh grade, my English teacher had us build a model of the Globe Theater.
Oh, in the UK.
In the UK. The Shakespearean Theater.
Yeah.
And it was just an enormously exciting, fun, interesting thing for me. And then it happens that I had a neighbor who was an architect I started talking to about. He had the only architect design home in the neighborhood.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And so that was, that was the direction. And I loved to draw when I was a kid, even before that. And at the same time, I'm pretty good at math and physics and stuff. So I was able to have a balance of the kind of skills that go into architecture.
Amazing. I am not good at drawing straight lines or not straight lines. I'm not good at math. I'm not good at physics. So
it's
a good thing that I'm not an architect. Although I've had some architecture friends and acquaintances over the years, they talk about their collegiate experiences as architorture. They spent long nights building models.
Yes. I mean, there is something to be said for a little bit of an endurance test. Make sure that you really, really, really want to be an architect.
That's so funny. I mean, there's so many careers that have that like endurance test, but I guess that's necessary because in some ways, if you are an architect, it is years before you see a project to fruition. So that patience and endurance pays off at some point in the end.
One hopes, but there's the 10,000 hour rule, which, you break it down, it's like 5 or 6 years. And in architecture, we basically all come to understand that the education is really just the beginning. That you come out of school equipped to begin to do some useful things. Mm-hmm. But it takes a very long time, partly because it takes a long time to build a building. And so your learning curve of getting to do things, think about them, put them out there in the world, actually get them built. And before you know it, you're 35 years old and you've now just kind of got your first buildings under your belt.
Oh, wow. I mean, I remember when I graduated from law school, I definitely was not capable of practicing law, but I feel like you probably had a few more skills than I did coming out of that. But it's incredible that we're in such a society that focuses on immediate payoff. This idea of making it into your 30s and getting it is the right thing to do, but so hard for people to digest.
Well, and I think it is one of the things that prevents some people from getting into the profession, because it really is a commitment before you actually see much of a payoff. And it's also not noted for being a profession that makes tons of money. So you really have to have a love for the actual doing of the work. Otherwise, it really doesn't make sense. I will say for me, I was really fortunate that I got through school early. I graduated from high school early. I went to college early. And so by the time I was 24, I was working for Frank Gehry and making some really interesting projects. And Frank, at the time we went through the Reagan recession, and the office went down to, there were 7 of us in 1981. And so I got the opportunity to grow up in the office that had incredible opportunities ultimately presented to it. Although at the time, none of us could see that. That's all hindsight. But it allowed me to to really start to actually see projects get done.
Right.
They weren't my authorship, which was kind of a different story. I mean, I contributed to the design work, but they were Frank's visions. But, you know, included things like the temporary contemporary for the Museum of Contemporary Art here.
Got it.
And then ultimately projects in Europe and around the world. And so by the time I was 35, I had actually seen more stuff built that was really award-winning, interesting architecture than most people get to see in a lifetime.
That's incredible. I mean, you know, nobody likes a recession, but that ended up being a good catapult in that vein.
It created opportunities for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you've worked on some really incredible projects in your own right after that point. Are there some favorites as you think about that really stand out for you in terms of vision and what you were able to bring?
Sure. Although, as we all say, our favorite project is the one we're working on right now. Right. But of course, I can't. Being in Los Angeles, I can't actually tell you about most of the projects I'm working on right now because I have non-disclosure agreements with all of my clients. but the projects that we've been able to do that were, I think, really exciting and interesting vary from the Music Center's renovation and work we've been doing there for 20 years, little bits and pieces, but renovating the entire Music Center Plaza and making it much more open to the public now, as well as renovating the Mark Taper Forum a few mm-hmm. years ago. And that's been really very rewarding and was a kind of continuation of our work on Grand Park, so which is, you know, one of the major open spaces in Los Angeles. And so we were very proud of that. And then there are the commercial side of things of like Westfield Century City, things like the new School of Architecture for Woodbury.
Got it. Well, what's incredible, and I'll take two of those examples, or three of them really, which is the Music Center Plaza, Grand Park, and Century City. There, you know, one of the themes, I'm old enough and I've lived in LA long enough now for almost two decades to remember the before. And right. How closed off those spaces were, and what's interesting is how those spaces have really just opened up, and they have a very different feeling. And I, you know, I'm thrilled to see what happened to Grand Park pre-pandemic, and what will hopefully return to Grand Park post-pandemic, and the open spaces. But I think that posits a separate question, which is, you know, we go through life living in this city, and a lot of people think very carefully about the home they want to live in, and the curtains that they want, and the door cabinet, the cabinet colors. Even when people focus on that, they don't often focus then on what's outside their home, right? Mm-hmm. And the public spaces. How many people actively think about the public space they live in beyond just the neighborhood they live in? And yet, you're in the business of creating these public spaces that have to meet, if anything, these intuitive needs from people that they don't actively think about. I mean, how do you even start to think about how the public is going to approach a space and the relationship they need to have if they're not even thinking about that relationship?
Well, there's a huge tradition of these kinds of spaces, transformed enormously in the last, let's say, 50 years, especially by cars and the structuring of the city very differently than it was traditionally. And it's interesting to go back and forth, to look at the precedents of older cities where streets weren't designed around, you know, four-lane freeways sort of plowing through them, and understanding that there's a scale that human beings can feel. And that intimacy, that connectivity to your surroundings, is one of those intuitive things that I think make people feel comfortable. And as well as a kind of understanding of where you are. By that, I mean being able to, so these projects we were talking about, they're very open intentionally so that you can actually see where you are, you can see where you're going, you can feel that openness actually is a connectivity for you with the community. And that kind of connection is, I think, very deeply rooted for people and is part of what makes them feel comfortable.
I mean, and that's incredible. I mean, you know, all of the math and the physics is used to create this highly emotional experience. And it's tied in that way. It's
yeah. I mean, all those other things are subservient to that goal of the emotional connection that people have. And really, again, building that sense of community and that sense of identity people have with their place, whether it's their home and their dining room table, or whether it's, you know, their neighborhood and going for a walk with their dog, or whether it's, you know, their larger city and how they feel like they fit into it.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting. My parents love to watch House Hunters and House Hunters International. And it's interesting because you hear people talk about the feel, like, and what's most, there are a lot of people who make a lot of decisions on those shows based not just on the number of bedrooms they want, but it ultimately comes down to how did the space, not just in the home, but around the home, make us feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I went to buy my house, you know, I've lived in Hancock Park almost the entire time that I've lived in LA. So I've been incredibly fortunate in that respect. And I never want to leave this neighborhood, which is unfortunate because it means I can never move since it's being increasingly unaffordable. But people love their neighborhoods and they love the feel. How do you, when you're talking about an evolution, like a Grand Park, right? How do you preserve what people love and get the leeway to bring them the benefit of the doubt, shall we say, to bring them more of what they love? Because people are naturally skeptical of something new, right? Like, is this going to change things?
Well, I mean, you touch on the thing that is most difficult for us in this realm, the NIMBYism, right?
Yeah.
Of people, which is people being protective of what they know and being uncomfortable trusting that something they can't see, feel, hear, touch is going to be as good or better than what they have now. And so that's a really difficult thing that we spend a lot of time engaging with people in communities, talking about what is it that you love about your place, what's important about it to you, and presenting them with ways of understanding whatever it is we're proposing in ways that are tangible enough for them to feel comfortable they understand it. Now, it there's never 100% like, oh yeah, everybody loves this. Often we get to a point where most people really are enthusiastic. But, you know, that comes with building incredibly detailed models and making simulations and doing mock-ups at full size and having lots of really beautiful drawings. And again, being out there and engaging with people so that they understand that you're not trying to just gentrify their neighborhoods.
You know, and when we look at the before and afters, I mean, Grand Park's an incredible example of that. I mean, it was, at least in my experience, it's been embraced by the community. Mm-hmm. and people going down there. I love it. And every time we talk about doing an event, everyone's always suggesting we should do it at Grand Park pre-pandemic. And Century City is the same way. You look at something even like The Grove, which was a radical transformation and is such an intrinsic part of what LA is now, but was highly controversial at the time in what it does. And do you find that people are more comfortable once they see those things? Like, there's been more development like that in LA in the last 10 years than there probably was in the prior 20.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think once things are actually built and people get to use them and they get the benefits of them, the downsides as they perceive them tend to either go away or become more exaggerated.
How, when you look at society as a whole and like what LA is, how do those spaces come together to form a city identity? Is that even possible in such a sprawling enterprise, or does only Tulsa get like an identity because they're more compact?
Well, I think it's definitely, it's an issue that we're grappling with, that we always have. Los Angeles is a huge city physically and as well as in terms of population, and there are places of great density, but it has certain iconic visual elements, but it has, because it's so big and so flat, it has lots of homogeneous sort of character. And I think the issue for Los Angeles is to really regrow and build on its neighborhoods. Los Angeles was created through the Red Line. Mm-hmm. And so transit, I mean, it's so ironic that transit is what enabled Los Angeles to be born. So
and then Los Angeles promptly bit the hand that fed it and destroyed it.
Well, it did. It basically, you know, the streetcars got in the way of the cars, and so we got rid of the streetcars and had the cars instead.
It's crazy.
It's a crazy kind of history. But what it did is there are those centers that were originally the main transit stops that are the centers of various neighborhoods. And Los Angeles is really a very large city made up of lots of neighborhoods. And I think the building back of the strength of those neighborhoods is really the future of making this an even better, more livable city.
Well, I think that's really important. We, you know, in law school, we cover property law, which I was not good at. But I remember vividly that there was an article in one of my law textbooks. I don't know if property is in here, but in the and it was, and it explained that LA first was it was like a conglomeration of like 100 cities that all got or neighborhoods that got manipulated into being one big city. And then it said when they built LA, the whole idea was that you would have these multiple decentralized centers and then you would live outside of them and go into your center. And then the whole thing fell apart when people lived in one center and went to another center. And that's what created gridlock.
Right.
And so essentially the solution to gridlock is and to the future of the city is, hey, everybody, this is what's supposed to happen is to make people live, invest and work in the neighborhoods that they care about. And then, you know, build character around these neighborhoods. Is there a part of LA or a city in the US that's doing that particularly well as we?
Well, there's an idea that's now starting to be picked up by some of the larger scale developers who are the ones who are actually investing and building in new communities and redeveloping communities. And that's the idea that they talk about is the 15-minute city.
Yeah.
Where everything you need on a daily basis is within a 15-minute walk. Which, if you extrapolate that, that's basically like to say a 2-mile sort of radius.
Okay. That's amazing. I think that would be terrifying to everyone in LA who's commuting an hour and a half in every direction.
Right.
But that seems like heaven. I mean, I think most of the city would settle for a 30 minute city.
Right. Well, one of the fundamental rules of urban design is that there's a direct relationship between accessibility and density. And so where you get people want to access things and where you can get to someplace, the density goes up, and the density going up means the price of the land goes up. And so you can sort of map that sort of rule all the way around Los Angeles and places. And of course, that gets mitigated by how neighborhoods are taken care of and different unique conditions. But fundamentally, that's a kind of issue that you just can't really get completely away from unless you do something, like I said, with the community land trust, where the value of the land isn't controlled by the market.
I mean, it's incredible. When people think about their neighborhoods, I think, you know, people often move into a neighborhood because they find a home they love and the street they're on looks great. And then they move there and they figure out, okay, this neighborhood is great, but I have to go trek 30 minutes for my favorite grocery store or whatever that is. And those questions, schools, as you have kids, become important. When people are thinking about place, they don't often think about these types of questions. How do we build, is it even possible to build a wider sort of public discourse or education that takes place outside of development, right? Like, there's the necessary conversation that you're having with the community when you're developing a new space, mm-hmm. but would that conversation be easier if we were continuously engaging people already on the concept of space and what they wanted from the space around them?
Well, yeah, it would. And there are venues and avenues for that. That was, to some degree, a lot of the impetus behind the creation of the neighborhood councils in Los Angeles. When I first was moving here, we had, I don't remember how many council districts, but you only had the city council people. Right. And then maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, this issue became part of what was really seen as problematic in Los Angeles, is people not having a way of being included in the discussion. And so neighborhood councils were formed as a way of trying to allow them a venue to get out and actually hear what is being discussed and contribute to that discussion. I think that's worked for those who really want to put in the energy to do it. I will say this is one of the, you know, the silver lining aspects of COVID and the whole, like, okay, you don't actually have to go someplace to participate. I've been on lots of public meetings. I've presented our work to design commissions and public forums on Zoom. And, you know, they say that you get 3 or 4 times more people participating in those than they did before. And because they also don't have a kind of in-person question and answer sort of condition, people tend to be more willing to write up their comments and send them in and feel like they've actually participated.
Well, it'd be great to. I mean, I love the neighborhood council concept in theory. It's also, you know, and I think all of these things, like the greater engagement over Zoom, reducing those barriers are critically important. And then, you know, I was looking at the neighborhood councils and it was shocking to me. I mean, there were people who were elected with 3 votes or 14 votes in neighborhood councils where districts are thousands of people.
Yes.
You know, there's like 4 people voting in a district for a representative out of the 10,000 eligible. It's insane. And yet these are the people making the decisions, or at least representing the public or the venue for public input around the entire concept of space.
Yeah, it is shocking. And it is one of those things where, you know, people's interest is balanced by their ability and their patience and their true interest in participating. And it is shocking when we do a major project and go out and try to get people to give us input, and it's like pulling teeth. But the minute you announce that you're doing something, there's like screaming all over, why didn't I know about this? How can you be doing this in my neighborhood? It's mine. And you, well, we asked. You didn't show up to give your input.
I mean, that's the damned if you do, damned if you don't argument, I guess, which is, you know, there are so many people who are invested in the concept, but not in the effort. I wonder, maybe that's the case for civic engagement as a whole is up during this, but is horrible in a normal time. Like, I don't know that people even understand that there's a responsibility,
right,
to craft your, right, space, to, right, be involved in the crafting of your space.
Right. And there's a responsibility to participate.
Yeah. If we could just reduce the barriers and I think help people understand even what's at stake, civic education being not Los Angeles's greatest strength. When people are thinking about the space around them, outside their home and their communities, are there questions that they should be asking themselves about what the future looks like or how to bring it about? Or like, if what would be the first step if we were to say, okay, we want to engage people, and the one piece of information we need people to be thinking about is X when it comes to their communities and their space? What is that? How do even people start?
Well, you may not be aware, The entire zoning code of the city of Los Angeles is being redesigned,
yes,
as we speak.
In a very, very long process. It is almost 7 years in run now?
Well, maybe 7 years. I'm working on something that's been going on for 5 years. And it was being discussed for many years before that. But the zoning code fundamentally wasn't changed since I think the 30s.
Yeah, it's a disaster. I
mean, so yeah, it's not like it doesn't need to happen, but I can also tell you that the code that's being written today is going to transform the way our city looks and feels. It's very form based. It's actually in my mind, a lot of it is retro sort of perspective, retrograde, because it really is trying to, on the one hand, preserve what's good about the existing city, and on the other hand, say, well, we should drag that as a precedent into the future of what the city should be like, which I'm all for keeping the good stuff, but I'm also for the fact that we can create even better new stuff. And so we'll see how it goes. It's got a long, it's still got a long slog to get approved.
I mean, it's crazy to me. I was looking into the zoning about how long it is, and the fact that the vast majority of people are not aware of it, right? Like, and those who are the quote unquote noisy neighbors, right? The people who want to be involved. And yet those people don't often represent the opinions of the public, right? Like, you know, how many people in my neighborhood, there was a question of whether there's a building a mile down the road about whether they were going to turn it into a luxury boutique hotel. And, you know, in a neighborhood of 40,000 people, I don't know that that many people would have been opposed to where it is. It's not in the middle of the neighborhood. It's off on the edge of the neighborhood. It would have brought an aesthetic, a sensibility, things like that. And yet it was railroaded by a group of people who very much wanted to be involved in that process. And I don't know, we'll never know if they represented public opinion or not, right? And and it's crazy to me how long these processes are. The zoning Larchmont here near me, which exists on its own zone, right? And they banned fitness centers, but then they modified it to allow fitness centers except spin studios so that they could open a spin studio because they wanted one. And I was like, this defeats the point of zoning, right? You literally are making ad hoc exceptions to say, okay, and we want to preserve absolutely the mom and pop nature of Larchmont. I love that look and feel. And yet we have 8 coffee shops and 6 ice cream shops because we refuse to allow one more family-owned restaurant with sit-down seating. It gets in the way of itself. I mean, on an insider's POV, is our rezoning plan going well, or are we headed down that bad path or that challenging path, shall we say?
Well, I think for Larchmont, actually, I think Larchmont will come out well. This neighborhood is, I think, are you in an HPOZ?
Yes.
Okay.
So very much so.
I mean, HPOZs, if they're in the right place, are not unreasonable as a way of maintaining the character of a neighborhood. The problem is there are places where they want to impose HPOZs and other restrictions like that, where there's like no particular coherence to the neighborhood. And so it's basically,
they just want to freeze it in time, no matter whether it deserves it or not.
Well, and they want to impose a certain set of rules that will result in certain kinds of architecture and not others that have nothing to do with even what's there. It's really a planner's point of view about what a good neighborhood should be like, which is really dangerous in a place like Los Angeles, where there's so much diversity. There's so many different people. There's so much area. To say there's some singular right way of looking at it is just not right.
We're going to turn the whole city into an Art Deco mecca, and that's it. Whether you're in Baldwin Hills or the Valley, we're going to force everyone to conform
that's
to
what
Art
doing.
Deco.
That's
insane.
It is.
So what you're saying is the first step would be for anyone who's watching this to please get involved and Google Recode LA, I think it's been called.
Recode LA.
Google the rezoning effort, learn what zoning is.
Yes.
Or just beg your neighborhood council who was elected by 4 votes to have some sort of.
Go find out who your neighborhood council is and what they think of these things.
I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. I mean, the sense of space and the sense of city is so important. And we see these seminal creations, LA Live and The Grove, and like they become iconic. Even I remember when the lamps exhibit at LACMA went up and people thought it was ugly at first, and now it's the center of the Instagram universe. And they're so important, and yet we're not engaged. And understandably, if you're struggling to put food on the table or struggling to keep your job or your apartment, all of those things take precedent. But we don't create any mechanism to help people get involved either.
Well, yeah. I mean, I have no answer to that. I mean, if I did, I would be working on it. But I think there are mechanisms that are there, and we try to make the best of them. And like I said, some of it becomes the challenge. Like on Grand Park, I'll give you an example. We had over 110 public meetings to communicate with various community groups and stakeholders about what we wanted to do, or starting out asking them what they wanted. And we designed essentially a game board that had pieces and to help people be able to communicate what some of their priorities would be. And it was really fun. So you get 10 people around a game board and you talk about where should a dog
thing
go.
I would like the stage and this dog park. Right. Okay.
And it was a thoughtful way to engage with people about what was important to them.
Legos for design and community building. All
right. Right. And yeah, we won an award for that engagement because it was thoughtful and planned. And most of the time I will say it becomes pro forma. And so I think people that try to engage and try to participate often aren't received well and aren't often encouraged in a way that would bring them back again. And that's too bad, because I think at the end of the day, most of our work is made better by people's engagement. There's not, when we're talking about the city writ large, there's not one person's opinion that's going to make it brilliant. It's really the accumulation of the kind of knowledge that the community has as a whole. And it's the question of untapping all that and providing leadership to that that is going to get you someplace that is really going to be great in the end.
I mean, I mean that's a perfect encapsulation, and then it's your responsibility as an architect to distill all of that into something that is manifested and real. And that sounds like an insanely difficult job.
It is sometimes, but it's a fun job.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining today, and thank you for tuning in to The World According to Craig with Bob Hale. And if there's one lesson we've learned, it's that where you live and what it feels like is important, and it's changing. So start asking questions now or have regrets later. And in the meantime, I'll be here talking with Bob Hale and relying on his expertise to try to get us through it. Thank you so much.
No, well, thank you, Craig. It was awesome. Fun.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to The World According to Craig. When I started this podcast, I didn't know what I was doing, and I still don't. But now I have the stories of a lot of incredible people who do know what they're doing. And for that, I'm truly grateful. I hope you tune in every week for more stories just like this one.